Experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
I'm Larry Rifkin. Kenneth Woodward is with us. And Kenneth, I used to read you all the time in Newsweek. I was a longtime subscriber. And, of course, you on the religion beat for so many years. The new book is called Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. And just to bring us to the present, it's interesting in this 2016 race, we used to talk all the time, I think in 2012, 2008, about the evangelicals and group and where they were aligning within the Republican Party. We don't hear that much about them in this cycle.
You know, you're absolutely right, and I'm not surprised. I mean, I still keep a hand in talking to people. And I heard a year ago from people who traveled in those sort of evangelical political circles and saying there's not going to be a lot of pastors participating in this. And there was Jerry Falwell Jr. and one or two others, but that was really on the margin, and I don't think they have a following. So why aren't they? Well, you know, if Cruz were the guy or the nominee, or maybe Rubio, who have legitimate evangelical credentials, then they might have got enthused about one of their own. But Trump is clearly not one of their own.
Okay, what about Hillary Clinton? I mean, she, a Methodist background. And she has been talking a little bit more about her religion of late. But we don't think of either of these candidates as particularly steeped in religion.
Well, she is, and I have a section of my book precisely on that, and a slice of that is going to appear in the Wall Street Journal later this week for me. And it's almost too long to go into what I call the Methodist moment. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party begins with a very Methodist senator from South Dakota, son of a minister, raised in a manse, went to a Methodist school, college,
yes,
studied for the ministry, switched to history, went back and taught at a Methodist college, George McGovern.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went back and studied the Methodist Book of Resolutions, their statement on public issues and social issues in 1972, which was put together 3 months before the Democratic and Republican parties, almost word for word in some places. The Democratic platform echoes what the Methodists said. And Hillary is somebody who carries that Book of Resolutions around with her, I should say. Yeah.
Mm.
And she really represents a Methodist outlook, and it's what I call righteous politics. And it's both righteous in the good sense and it's self-righteous at the same time.
Interesting, because we don't think about the Methodists a lot up here in the Northeast.
Well, you don't. And by the way, I spent 40 years just south of you in Westchester County.
Mm-hmm.
We're recent here to Chicago. I know they don't, and I make a big effort in the last chapter of the book. Second last talks about the Republicans and basically the religious right. Then this one says, well, what about the Democrats? After all, the largest single constituency of the party right now are the religiously non-affiliated. Okay, I'm here.
You were making the point about the largest constituency in the Democratic Party today.
Yeah, religiously speaking, it's the non-affiliated atheists, you know, agnostics and simply non-affiliated. And then a lot of those are the young. And they may, something may happen later on. But in any case, they're bigger than the African American constituency, bigger than the women's constituency. So how can they claim a, how do you relate religion to the Democratic Party? Well, I invite the reader to look at it through the lens of Methodism. And I go on to explain that basically Methodism was the muscular activist side of liberal Protestantism going back to the middle of the 19th century. So they're the ones that gave us prohibition. Thank you very much. And so I think if you look at it, you say, yeah, I see that. I see that. This she will talk about, and Obama even uses the same language. You know, I believe in activism and all that kind of stuff. That's all very, very Methodist.
That's interesting. So I think people, you know, if you really are looking for another way into this race, you may want to kind of check out not only the book, Getting Religion, Kenneth Woodward, and that would be a great thing, but also just Methodists and what they believe. And then you get a greater insight into Hillary Clinton. What about Donald Trump? I mean, what denomination did he say? Is he Presbyterian?
He says Presbyterian, but look, he went to Norman Vincent Peale's church. Why would you go to Norman Vincent Peale's church? I'm not a big Peale fan. Well, because he's another celebrity. That's why. I don't think he's got an ounce of religion in the man, for that matter. And I think and his behavior doesn't manifest itself in that way at all. So, but I would say this, and I do say it in the book, it is extremely difficult to find any kind of connection between the religious commitment, if there is one, of a president and public policy. There was a lot of, and I have to bring this up, there's a lot of worry on the political left when Bush Jr. was president, saying this is a theocracy because he talks about Jesus every other sentence and so on. He didn't actually that much. Well, they don't remember that when Dwight Eisenhower was president, in his second term, the Republican National Committee put out a statement, front page of the New York Times, but nobody bothered much when they said, President Eisenhower is not only the commander-in-chief and president of the country, he is the spiritual leader of our times. Now, nothing has happened since then to match that kind of overstatement, that kind of spiritual claim on the President of the United States.
And remind us back in, I mean, because you go back into the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and so forth. I mean, when we go back to John F. Kennedy and, you know, breaking through the wall as a Catholic, I mean, just take us back to that era and how much religion was a part of the conversation politically.
Well, you know, I was there. Believe me, I was there. I'm Catholic. This was the first Catholic president. We knew what had happened to Al Smith and so forth. What the story I tell in the book is how Billy Graham, Peale, and others, but especially Billy, whom I knew very well, pretended to be neutral. And Billy wrote to Lyndon Johnson, who was a buddy of his, and said, I'm staying out of this race. Remember, he ran for vice president with Kennedy. Well, he didn't. He went to Montreux, Switzerland, and gathered a bunch of people, called them over there, and we said, we've got to stop this. Anyhow, we find it reprehensible now, but it was a long period when American Protestants, and my father was one of them, who felt that you know, the Pope was going to have too much control over the country. This was essentially a Protestant country. Everything in our culture was Protestant, and they were half right. So they were really scared, and so I revisit this in my book. And when Kennedy heard of the plot, it was exposed by a guy who later came to Newsweek in the Washington Post. That's when he spoke to the Houston Ministers Association and gave that famous speech, And that just might have won it, that and a little chicanery here by Governor Daley.
There you go. In Chicago, Cook County. Yeah, absolutely. You know, did we break through something, a barrier this year that we never really discussed? And by that I mean, of course, Joe Lieberman was on the Al Gore ticket, and they got more popular votes, and he would then have been one heartbeat away. But, you know, Bernie Sanders, the whole issue of religion and being the first Jewish candidate who could win primaries, and I don't think it was discussed much. I don't think anybody really talked about it a lot, and maybe that's because Bernie Sanders did not. But did we break through another barrier, or, you know, perceived barrier this year?
I don't think we're a very religious country at this point, and one of the, but this was a good thing. I remember our Mel Elfin, our legendary Washington bureau chief, saying when Goldwater ran, I always knew the first Jew to run for president would be an Episcopalian. and Bernie clearly isn't, you know, he is what he is. The secular Jew. I mean, he comes up from that side. Oh, you see it in the 40s and the 50s socialist, you know, from the middle of Europe and from Eastern Europe, Jewish socialist tradition. That's where he's from. And the kids got into him because he was going to give them free education. But anyhow.
So they didn't care what his religion. Well, let me ask you, as you went and you studied, and by the way, you're good friends with the Dalai Lama, I know. And your friends, I mean, Billy Graham, of course, part of, your being over the years. When you think about, you know, some of the major figures that were religious, but also kind of crossed over into political, life, Martin Luther King Jr., of course. I mean, who has had the greatest impact, on a movement or on changes politically as you have seen it over the years? Or give us, some of the real.
Well, let me just mention a couple of these things. One is Billy told me, and it's in the book, how much he regretted how political he got under Nixon, okay? He said he regretted it, and he did change his ways. He stayed out. He became a world figure. The greatest figure that makes politics and religion, of course, was Pope John Paul II. Mm. That's on the world stage. I mean, it's very difficult to cut him out of the equation or cut him out of the whole drama of the fall of communism. And he was extremely gifted intellectually. So I would say that. But in this country, you cannot walk around any which way Martin Luther King, who also, by the way, studied at a Methodist seminary. So that we shall overcome. There's that whole mix of Gandhi, nonviolence, and the rest. What happens after that, what I call movement religion, and then we get through several other movements, coming out of it. But his influence was powerful. And we have tried to, or various groups have tried to, repeat that, and it can't be done because he came out of the black church and he articulated the longings in, African-American hymns, which come out of the slavery movement. It was a peculiar time. Yeah, I have to laugh. There are people who said, when I marched with King. Well, if all the people had been down there marching with King, there would have been nobody at home in the Northern Hemisphere.
I know. We've got everyone in Connecticut said they were a pioneer. What about the Dalai Lama? Because I don't know quite what to make of the Dalai Lama. I haven't studied him the way you have and known him. I mean, his influence around the world, how transcendent is it?
Well, let me, this is a somewhat irreverent book. The only guy that really comes off without any criticism whatsoever is Rabbi Abraham Heschel, who was my mentor in things Jewish. And he was 30 years older, so I could be a little worshipful, but he was a transcendent human being. Dalai Lama is likable, and he's non-offensive. People read into him like they do with Pope Francis now, what they want to hear. And so my conversations with him in the book are about what I call the transformations of Buddhism when it gets embraced by Americans, especially upper middle class. I call it designer Buddhism. They cut out the stuff they don't want, they don't want to bother with, and they just stick with the other. It's a way of being religious without being religious, I think, and I think he's offended by that to some extent. But, yeah, we've had some funny conversations. I always used to rib him. I'm saying, he said to me at one, I was at Dharamsala at his home in India, and he says, oh, old friend, I'm getting old. I have only a few more years active. This is way back when he was 65. And I said, Your Holiness, I said, you and I are the same age, minus a few incarnations. Well, and I'm going to be active. Well, he laughs at that and so on. And what I was interested in is not the political significance and all of that, but really, how did he understand himself? It's a very complicated thing to be worshipped as the reincarnation of the God of mercy, and that's what, or of compassion. And he tells me in the book, I got to tell you this story. He says, "Have dream. In dream, am not Dalai Lama, am monk, core identity monk. In dream, woman come. I remind myself, I am monk." And that's an insight into the man. That's how he understands himself. And all this other business, he's not previous incarnations and all that sort of thing. He's like a learning it all himself in a way. So he's a very approachable guy, but he's non-confrontational. And the young especially like that sort of thing. They don't want people telling they ought to be doing something. But of course the Dalai Lama tells you should be doing things. But that's just not how we perceive.
Well, in closing for this conversation, and sure. I've enjoyed every minute, Daniel Berrigan, of course, we had, Joe Duffy, who was a clergyman.
I knew Joe very well.
Yeah, yep. And he ran for the Senate here in Connecticut. I mean, when we think about the anti-war movement and religion crossing over with the Berrigans and with him, I mean, how do you look at that in terms of their influence during that era?
And I was drawn to it. I mean, I knew Dan. I had the Jesuits in high school. So you get brought into their bloodline. But they were arrogant. Oh, my God, they were arrogant. And I had to review this in the front page of the Sunday New York Times, a book, Berrigan's book. And it was so arrogant. He hated his father and all this kind of stuff. And I told my wife, I said, what am I going to do? Well, I told her as I felt it was. I think Daniel Berrigan, after the war movement and after all of that, became a much more deeply, profoundly religious figure. That's a story for, that was the story that was told in his obituary. Everybody remembers the anti-war years because he was a public figure.
Yeah.
It's when he was washing the sick and doing that kind of stuff that he really rose, in my judgment.
Well, fascinating, really. Great insights. And for people who care about politics and religion, no better book, no better purveyor of this content than Kenneth Woodward, Getting Religion. Thank you so much for being with us today. An honor to have you on the program.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your question.